This is a download from BFM 89.9. The Business Station.
Good afternoon. This is Earth Matters on The Bigger Picture, and I'm Juliet Jacobs. With over 1,300 species, bats illustrate many key issues in ecology and evolution, from the beauty of their unique biology to the importance for ecosystem services and conservation. Now, scientists here have discovered that Southeast Asia's highly popular durian tree is pollinated by locally endangered fruit bats known as flying foxes. Dr. Shima Abdul Aziz, the co-founder, president, and principal investigator of local conservation research group RIMBA, led the study in Malaysia as part of her PhD, and she joins me now to share her findings. Welcome, Shima. How are you today?
Hi, Juliet. Thanks very much.
Oh, my pleasure having you. Thank you so much. So, Shima, you are the only ecologist in Malaysia, if I'm not mistaken, specializing in flying fox conservation ecology. What got you interested in these flying mammals?
Well, I actually became interested in bats a long time ago. Initially, I was like a lot of other people, I guess. I didn't really think much about bats. I didn't pay attention to bats, and I didn't think they were important in any way. Mm-hmm. And then one day, I actually won a fellowship from, it was an Earthwatch HSBC joint fellowship to volunteer on a bat research project in Krau Wildlife Reserve in Pahang. And this project was led by Dr. Tigger Kingston, who's now at Texas Tech University. And I was volunteering on that project for 2 weeks. And at the time, I didn't think much of it. I thought, well, bats are kind of boring. They're not interesting animals. I'm not sure, you know, I really would be interested in doing something like this. And all of that changed as soon as I held the very first bat in my hand. As soon as I looked at the bat and I looked at its furry little face and its cute, tiny little eyes, I just completely fell in love. Mm-hmm. And so that was sort of the start of my journey, really, into researching bats. So I decided to go off and do a master's because I didn't have a science background. I decided I want to study bats. So I decided to actually do a master's in conservation biology, and I wanted to really focus on studying bats. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I was really interested in specifically was fruit bats. So the bats that were being studied in that project in Krau at the time were insectivorous bats. Mm-hmm. So I was really curious about the fruit bats because these are bats that are actually feeding in trees, on plants. And they have this very unique relationship with plants. And I was really surprised that at the time, nobody in Malaysia was really looking at this because I thought, well, they must play some kind of important role in the ecosystem. You know, they must be really important for rainforests. Yeah. But there was very little data on it. There were very little studies that were looking at it. And so I decided, you know, maybe this is what I should look at. This should be my research focus. So that's how I started.
You then kind of made it the focus of your PhD as well, you know. What was that journey like going from there to, you know, from just that looking at the little furry face and going all the way there?
Yeah, well, so I went from thinking about, oh, fruit bats are really cool and really interesting, to then finding out, actually, we have these giant fruit bats in Malaysia. They're called flying foxes. In Malay, we call them kluang. And they're these really big bats. You know, the biggest species is what? It can be 1 kilo in weight.
Wow.
Yeah, and its wingspan can be more than 1 meter long.
Gosh.
So there are these really cool, really interesting animals that we have in our forests here in our country. And again, I was convinced they must be playing some kind of really important role because, you know, they can travel very long distances. They can carry big fruit. So I was sure that they must be important for maintaining the health of rainforests. But again, there was just no work that had been done on it. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, we knew that these flying foxes were being really, really badly affected by hunting. So hunting pressure is very high in Malaysia, especially, but also throughout Southeast Asia. A lot of people like to eat these flying foxes. Mm. And so they've just been disappearing so rapidly from our country. And we don't even know what is the effect of this disappearance. How is it actually having an impact on our forests, on our ecosystems? And so I decided that I wanted to investigate that further and find out if there were ways that we could argue for the conservation of these flying foxes, you know, to show people how they're important and why we shouldn't let them go extinct. And that's why I decided to do a PhD, actually, to focus on this topic.
Okay. So, okay, we'll get into your research in depth a little bit later. But maybe before we get into that, can you give us a brief 101 on bats in general? So like I mentioned earlier in the intro, there are about over 1,300 species. How many of those are actually found in Malaysia?
So Malaysia actually has a very high diversity of bat species. And there was actually a checklist of bats that was done recently for Malaysia, for Peninsula Malaysia. And we know that in Peninsula Malaysia, we have more than 100 species of bats that are currently documented. So this checklist, it was actually compiled by a PhD student, Vun Ching Lim, and this checklist shows us that we have at least 110 species of bats just in Peninsula Malaysia alone. Out of these bats, so there are two kind of main groups of bats. There are the bats that are insectivorous, that feed on insects, and then there are the bats that are known as fruit bats. And they're the ones that feed on fruit, flowers, pollen, nectar, leaves. And out of these 110 bats, about 18 of them are fruit bats, and the rest are all insectivorous.
Okay, it's so weird for, you know, the layman, because you're just like, oh, bats are bats, right?
Yeah, so you don't realize that actually they're so diverse. They're a very diverse animal group. They have all kinds of different shapes, sizes, behavior, diet, habitat needs. Mm-hmm. And Malaysia is actually it's a very important country for bat conservation, because we do have one of the highest bat diversity levels in the whole world.
Okay. And you know, they're well known. Okay, like I said, you know, a lot of us think of them as just pests, or they're just these creatures that sometimes, you know, go and infest your roof. You know,
that's right.
The unfortunate rep that they have. But actually, they are well known for their key ecological roles, you know, like pollination, like you mentioned, pest control, seed dispersal. Maybe you could elaborate a bit on that for us.
Okay, so like I mentioned, there's sort of two main groups of bats, right? There's the ones that feed on insects. And these insectivorous bats are very important because they provide pest control services. Mm-hmm. So they help eat, you know, all the annoying little insects that might make human lives difficult. For example, there was research in Thailand that actually found that insectivorous cave bats are contributing to the local rice industry, because they actually feed on millions of these rice pests, these insect pests that feed on rice. The bats are actually eating them up. And so that actually provides a service to the rice industry.
Organic farming right there.
Yeah, exactly. So you don't need to use your pesticides or insecticides. And then for fruit bats actually play a dual role. So they're important for pollinating flowers. You know, when they go to feed on the nectar, they're actually helping to transfer pollen from one flower to another. But at the same time, they're also important for dispersing seeds. So because they feed on fruit, they actually take the fruit and fly off with it away from the parent tree, which means that they're actually helping to plant seeds in the rainforest. Sometimes also, these bats, they eat a lot of figs. So when they swallow the fig seeds and they defecate in mid-flight, then they're also helping to plant fig trees as well. So they're actually very important for maintaining the health of rainforests.
So I was reading that over 1,000 of these recorded bat species, they're actually considered vulnerable or worse on the IUCN red list. So there's 26 being critically endangered and about 51 being endangered. I think a lot of people don't even know that bats are, even in the endangered species at all. We see millions of them flying all the time, you know, we consider them pests. But what actually are the factors contributing to them being, you know, even on this endangered species list?
So because bats are such a diverse animal group, they also face very diverse threats. So for different bat species, there are different threats. Like I mentioned earlier, fruit bats like flying foxes are very severely threatened by hunting. But there are other bats, the smaller bats, for example, that are very dependent on the forest, and they're very threatened by deforestation. So they depend on the forest for their habitat, but also for their food. So when we replace forests with plantations, for example, we're not just eliminating their homes, we're also eliminating the food resources that they depend on. Mm-hmm. At the same time, some bats also depend on caves, which is kind of, you know, the popular idea or image of bats, right? So there are some bat species that do roosting caves. Some of them are very dependent on very big cavern-like caves for their habitat, and they are actually very severely threatened by limestone quarrying. Mm. So because we're quarrying so much of our limestone now in Malaysia for the cement and marble industries, it's actually affecting the habitat of these bats. And if they lose the caves, then they either have nowhere else to go and they might die out, or they might start moving more into human areas and roosting in our cities and towns, which might then create a problem for people, and, you know, it might create conflict.
And then from the conflict comes the eradication of them. And then we don't know
exactly
what are the sort of ecosystem effects that's going to have.
That's
right?
Right. Yeah. So it might actually affect us in negative ways. But, you know, we don't know yet until it actually starts to happen.
Okay. And I was reading, like, you know, in overseas, things like wind turbines and things like that are also some of the contributing factors to this.
Yes.
So basically the removal of their natural habitat is, you know.
And the alteration of their natural landscapes. It's creating huge problems for bats all over the world.
And I think a lot of us know that bats have a very bad rap, perhaps unfair one, because they are known as reservoirs for zoonotic pathogens. There's a lot of research into those sorts of links, the links between bats and human disease. But what is the effect of that on, you know, the research for the conservation of bats?
Yeah, so this has become a bit of a problem for bat conservationists in recent years. There has actually been a lot of research conducted on the links between bats and diseases. And sometimes these are just based on theories with no definite evidence to actually prove the links. So, for example, when Ebola broke out in Africa and scientists said that they thought bats were the source of it, there was actually no evidence to prove that at all, but the media just jumped on it and said that bats were causing Ebola. And so there's now been this hugely disproportionate focus on just researching the links between bats and disease and how bats are hosts for viruses. And this is actually creating problems for bat conservation because it creates this very negative impression of bats. You know, it makes people scared of bats. It makes people want to kill bats. And it just adds to this whole negative reputation that bats already have. And at the same time, it's really just redirecting all these resources and efforts to just looking at research about diseases. Mm-hmm. And there's not enough that's being done to actually conduct research that will help conservation of bats and also the ecosystems that depend on bats. So there's actually very little interest in researching conservation ecology of bats, you know, the ecosystem services that bats provide and why they're beneficial to us. And if we don't have this kind of research and all we have is just research that paints a negative picture of bats, then it's going to be very difficult to convince people to conserve bats.
Well, lucky you're here to kind of help in that area. I'm speaking today to Dr. Shima Abdul Aziz. She's the co-founder, president and principal investigator at RIMBA, which is a conservation research group. And she was also the lead author of a new study which showed the role that flying foxes, which are fruit bats, that they play in durian pollination. We'll find out more about that research after this quick break. You are listening to Earth Matters on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. This is Earth Matters on The Bigger Picture, and I'm Juliet Jacobs. In the studio with me today is Dr. Shima Abdul Aziz. She's the co-founder, president, and principal investigator at RIMBA, which is a conservation research group here in Malaysia. And we are actually discussing the role of bats in ecosystem services and, you know, all the kind of wonderful things that they do for our conservation, despite the bad rep that they kind of get. And Shima actually was the lead author of a study that focused on our own local fruit bats, or kluang, or flying foxes as they're known. So Shima, these fruit bats, they're actually rapidly disappearing from our forests as well. Why is that happening?
I would say that the main threat to our kluang, to our flying foxes, is hunting pressure. So in the past, these bats have just been hunted so heavily because they are believed to have medicinal properties, which is completely unproven, unfounded. But they are also eaten as exotic meat as well. And it's not just in Malaysia, it's also throughout Southeast Asia. And because of this, they've just been hunted over decades with very little control. So there are hunting licenses that you need to apply for to hunt these bats, but not everybody bothers to apply for these licenses. So there's a lot of illegal hunting that's been going on. Also, these bats come into conflict with fruit farmers a lot because, you know, they're fruit bats. They feed on fruits. So fruit farmers say that these flying foxes fly into orchards at night and eat up all their fruit and cause damage. And then this causes economic loss. So because of that, fruit farmers see flying foxes as agricultural pests. They don't see them as something positive. They see them as something negative, which should be eradicated. And again, this is because they don't know how important these bats are. They don't know what ecosystem services these bats are providing. And because of that, there's really been sustained efforts to kill these bats over a very long period of time. Mm-hmm. And we've started to notice the effects now. So whenever you talk to people of the older generation, they always say like, oh, we remember in the past there were so many flying foxes, you know, in the evening they would just fill the sky and, you know, there were thousands and thousands of them. But now you don't see them anymore. Now they're just very, very rare and it's not common to see flying foxes anymore. So just this anecdotal evidence alone is telling us that the hunting has had a very huge impact on flying fox populations in this country. And then at the same time, they're also affected by deforestation because they need natural areas to live in. They also need their food, which is found in the forests and in the mangroves. And if all of this disappears, then they start to move more into human areas, then they start to feed even more in orchards and plantations, and then that creates more conflict and more problems. And if people start killing the bats because of this, then you will have repercussions that will affect the ecosystem and ultimately will also affect our well-being in the long term.
Very vicious cycle we're talking about here, right?
Yes, that's right.
You led this study, and I think it was part of your PhD, which I think was done in collaboration with France. Am I mistaken?
So my PhD was done in France under the Muséum National d'Histoire Naturelle, which is the French Natural History Museum in Paris.
Okay.
And it was also done in collaboration with the University of Nottingham Malaysia campus as well.
Okay. So you had a lot of people working with you on this
yes,
as well.
Yes, I had a lot of people collaborating and helping me out. So I was very lucky.
So you focus a study on these flying foxes. I mean, you're trying to debunk the myth surrounding them?
To some extent, yeah. But I mean, I didn't purposely set out specifically to debunk myths per se, because the thing is, because there hasn't been much work done on these bats, there's actually so little that we even know about them. Mm-hmm. So we don't know what are the myths and what's the truth. So one of the reasons I decided to embark on this study was because I really just wanted to understand these bats better. I wanted to understand the situation. I wanted to understand what roles they were playing and how we can then develop specific conservation actions that are tailored for that particular situation. And I really wanted my research also to be able to help other people understand these bats better as well.
Yeah. Okay, so now maybe you can walk me through the whole research process. You know, I mean, so where did you decide to focus on? I know there was a focus on durian pollination. You know, why was that chosen? You know, maybe you could explain all of that.
Okay, so my PhD thesis basically focused on interactions between flying foxes and plants, but also interactions between flying foxes and humans. And I chose Tioman Island as my study site because it's one of the last few places where you can actually go to see these flying foxes in huge numbers. And they're actually quite easy to study there. It's one of the last few places where you can just easily find flying foxes roosting there because they've become so rare everywhere else. So I decided to conduct my study there and look at how the bats were interacting with plants in the forest, because Tioman is this big island which just has, you know, this beautiful, beautiful, pristine rainforest. You know, it's primary virgin rainforest and much of it is still untouched. It's this just huge tract of really nice rainforest. So I wanted to find out how the bats were interacting with the plants in the rainforest there, but I also wanted to find out how they were interacting with plants in the villages as well, you know, mm-hmm. the cultivated trees that the people were planting. And so I also wanted to find out how the bats might actually be affecting the lives of the people living on the island and what were the implications of that. And also, one of the aspects of my study was looking at durian pollination, as you mentioned. And that was really because I had found out that research in Thailand, in southern Thailand, had shown that durian trees were actually being pollinated by these smaller bats. They're nectar-feeding bats. Mm-hmm. They're called cave nectar bats, so they roost in caves. And these bats actually act as the primary pollinators for durian.
Okay.
But because these studies were done in areas where there were no flying foxes, we didn't know what the effect of flying foxes were. And we know from previous reports as early as the 70s that flying foxes do feed in durian trees. So people have observed flying foxes coming to durian trees and feeding on the flowers, but nobody knew the exact effect of these flying foxes. There were some people that actually believed that these flying foxes were destructive, that they were just eating the flowers or they were just knocking the flowers off the tree. And so we didn't have a good understanding of the role of flying foxes when it came to durians. So I thought, well, since I'm doing my study in a place where there are flying foxes and there also happen to be villages where there are durian orchards, why don't I try to do a durian pollination study to see whether the flying foxes are coming to the trees and what effect they have on the trees?
And I guess what were your sort of research methods? Because are they quite elusive? I am shooting in the dark here. Are they also one of those creatures that are not much known about them?
Yeah, so they wait until it's dark, in the evening, to fly out and forage for food. Mm-hmm. So they feed during the night. Mm-hmm. And because they're really big bats and they can fly very long distances, it's very hard for us to see where they go. It's very hard for us to follow them and see what they're feeding on exactly. So one of the things I did was I actually collected their feces. So I put plastic sheets underneath their roosts and I took these fecal samples. And I actually worked in collaboration with Monash University Malaysia to conduct molecular analysis of the feces to find out what were the plant species in the diet of these bats.
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah. And actually what we found was that their most favorite food more than anything else was actually wild figs in the forest.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. But then they also really love mangoes as well. So when the mango trees are fruiting, they eat a lot of mango. And again, because this means that they're coming into human areas, they're feeding in orchards, this does create a bit of conflict with people. And so it shows that there is a bit of a problem here that needs to be addressed in a constructive way.
And what are some of the other methods you use? You mentioned that you collected their fecal samples. I think you use cameras as well in this research.
Yeah, that's right. So for the durian pollination study, I actually put camera traps up in the durian trees. Mm-hmm. And the reason I did this was because you need to come up with a slightly different or a slightly unique approach to study flying foxes. So normally what people do when they study pollination is that they conduct exclusion experiments. So they bag some of the flowers with plastic bags or with netting to see what is the effect of a specific animal visitor on the flower.
Right.
You can't do that for flying foxes because the bats are so big. And if there are other bats also coming to the flowers, then, it's like, how do you exclude the smaller bat while, still allowing access to the flying fox? And
right.
So it becomes a question of, different sizes. It creates a logistical problem. So we decided to try and overcome this problem by using camera traps. And that actually worked out very well for us because, again, this came as a surprise because it was a new method that hadn't been tried before. And we just decided to test it out. And it actually ended up working really well. And we got a lot of really good data, a lot of really good video footage using this method. And it helped us to conduct analyses that then showed that the flying foxes were definitely having a positive effect on fruit production.
Okay. And like you said, this is the first time it was being used. So this is like never before seen evidence, I'm guessing.
Yes. Yeah. Uh-huh. So this is actually the first evidence, the first video footage showing flying foxes actually pollinating durian. And it's very important because a lot of people are just not aware of this. Even the orchard owners, a lot of them don't even know that flying foxes are coming to their orchards at night when the durians are in flower.
Yeah.
One of the other things I did in my study was I conducted a questionnaire survey. So I interviewed a lot of the people in the villages to ask them about their perceptions of the flying foxes and their experiences with the flying foxes. And the majority of people did not know that flying foxes were actually helping to pollinate their durian trees.
Maybe you can elaborate on that, your findings exactly. What were the things that you found out that the fruit bats were actually, how they were helping in durian pollination?
So what I found was that the flying foxes, when they come to the durian flowers, they're actually not feeding on the flowers. They're not eating the flowers. They're feeding on the nectar that the flowers produce.
Mm-hmm.
So they're actually just drinking the nectar. They're not biting the flowers. They're not destroying the flowers. They don't knock the flowers off the tree. So when they stick their faces into the flowers to get the nectar, and these are flowers that are, they're really big flowers, these durian flowers. They're actually the perfect shape, the perfect size for bat pollination.
Okay.
So, and you see that happening when the bats stick their faces into the flowers to get at the nectar, all the pollen gets stuck on their fur. And then when they move on to feed on another flower, then that pollen gets transferred to that flower. And so you get cross-pollination happening, and then that helps to produce the fruit.
Mm-hmm. I mean, maybe people don't understand what's the benefit of cross-pollination. Maybe would you be able to explain what's the benefit of that?
Well, durian is an interesting tree. It's what we call self-incompatible. So it's a tree that cannot pollinate itself. It cannot be wind pollinated. It needs an agent, a pollinating agent, like an animal, mm-hmm. to come and transfer pollen. Yeah, this is a bit of a technical topic to explain. Essentially, you need pollen to be transferred from one flower to a different flower.
Okay.
And ideally from one tree to a different tree,
mm-hmm.
because you need that genetic diversity in order to produce healthy fruit. So if that doesn't happen, then a lot of the time the tree just simply cannot produce fruit.
Okay. And so like you said, you need an agent to do that, like,
right.
like a flying fox, for example.
Right, that's right. So durian trees are actually especially dependent on animal pollinators. Mm-hmm. And what we're finding from our research, not just, you know, my study in Malaysia, but also previous research that's been done in Thailand, is that these durians are really especially dependent on bats, who seem to be the most efficient pollinators, if not the only pollinators.
And, you know, just going about that, the study in Thailand, I read in your study that farmers in southern Thailand, for example, they've resorted to artificial cross-pollination by hand in the absence of natural pollinators. Could you elaborate on that point for me?
That's right. So for my study, I actually collaborated with Thai scientists from Prince of Songkla University in Hat Yai. And they have conducted a lot of research on bat pollination of durian in southern Thailand. And according to them, what's happening in Thailand is that in a lot of durian orchards where there are no bats coming to the trees, the farmers are actually paying people to pollinate the flowers by hand, manually.
Mm-hmm.
So this is actually, you know, a huge expense because you have to pay people to do the work.
Yeah.
But it's also very risky, very dangerous work as well for the workers who are carrying it out, because you essentially have to put these really tall ladders up these really tall durian trees and then climb up the ladders to then, you know, use a brush or something to pollinate the flowers yourself.
My goodness.
And, you know, people do this without any safety harnesses or anything. So there's also this health and safety risk as well, because if you fall off one of these tall ladders, you could injure yourself quite badly.
So, I mean, it's time consuming. It's laborious.
Yeah, it's time consuming. It's laborious. And it's a health and safety issue. And at the same time, you have to spend more money to do this, which you wouldn't have to spend at all if you actually had bats who were coming to help pollinate your flowers for you. So this is actually a service that the bats are providing for us for free. So they're actually helping us out.
And you could say that going on the size of the flower is almost like they were designed to do something like this.
That's right. That's right. So what scientists believe is that bats and durian trees have actually co-evolved together,
mm-hmm.
To develop this, what they call a mutualistic relationship, where both parties actually derive a benefit from it. So the bats get food from the trees and the trees get pollination from the bats.
Are flying foxes the only known sort of, bat pollinators, I suppose, for the durian plant?
No, they're not the only known bats who pollinate durian. So before I actually conducted my study, we knew already from research in Thailand by the Prince of Songkla University researchers that the cave nectar bat is actually a major, major pollinator for durian trees. So the cave nectar bat is this much smaller bat, as its name suggests. It feeds mostly on nectar, and it also lives in caves. And these bats are very important for the durian industry. In areas where there are no flying foxes, these cave nectar bats are helping to pollinate durian. But they are actually very severely threatened by limestone quarrying. So because they depend on caves as their habitat, they're actually being reduced now by quarrying activities. So this is actually a case where, you know, people don't actually see the link.
Mm.
And it's actually becoming a huge problem now, because we've got so much quarrying of limestone going on throughout Southeast Asia, not just in Malaysia. And actually, the more you quarry limestone to produce cement and marble, the more you are going to affect the populations of the bats that are actually pollinating your durian, where there are no flying foxes. So it's not just, you know, flying foxes being threatened by hunting affecting durian. It's also the cave nectar bats being threatened by quarrying. And the more cement production you have, the more it's going to affect your durian production.
Gosh.
And I think a lot of people don't realize that, you know, these two things are actually linked.
I think a lot of people don't even realize that, you know, where their cement comes from or where their...
Yeah, that's right.
You
that's
know,
right.
It's just like, it's there. It's in a bag. I don't care.
Yeah.
They don't realize.
So the more you have construction activities going on, it's actually going to affect your durian industry.
And that's a very, very dire consequence for a lot of Malaysians.
That's right.
So I guess very plainly then, could you spell out what you think a further decrease in flying fox populations could mean specifically to the durian industry?
Okay, well, this is something that we don't quite know yet. We can only guess just based on the results of this study because this is still very preliminary research. It was a small sample size. So we know for a fact that flying foxes are pollinating durian. They're having a beneficial effect, not a destructive effect. And so because of this, we can expect that if flying foxes disappear, if they go extinct, it would likely have an effect on durian somehow. One possible effect is that durian trees might start producing less fruit. But also another effect could be that they might produce fruit of lesser quality. Mm-hmm. So maybe fruits that are smaller or fruits that don't taste as good as they used to. Because even where there are no flying foxes, there are still cave nectar bats pollinating durian. But is that enough? Is it a sufficient substitute for flying foxes? Maybe flying foxes are producing more fruit or producing better fruit. We don't know yet, but mm-hmm. it's possible that if they are no longer around to pollinate durian trees, then it might actually have an effect on the fruit production somehow. In what specific ways, we don't know exactly. And it might take a very long time before we actually see that effect because sometimes these changes, they happen very slowly and they could take years or decades before we actually see an effect. Mm-hmm. So just based on our research here, we think that there could potentially be an effect. We don't know what that is just yet. We have some theories. And we really need to conduct more research, more studies to really find out whether our suspicions are true.
Okay. And I mean, you know, you mentioned earlier that, you know, the orchard owners you spoke to, you did the questionnaire and they didn't know that the flying foxes were there. And I'm guessing they had some very negative views on bats there. I mean, do you hope your research will change this, you know, especially since you have something new, you've got video evidence, you know, to prove otherwise.
Yeah, that's right. So in general, people who own fruit trees have very negative attitudes towards bats. And to some extent, I don't blame them because bats do feed on their fruits. Mm. And I can imagine if I was a fruit farmer, then I would find this very annoying, especially if it might be affecting my livelihood. So that's just one side of the story. So a lot of fruit farmers, they only see the negative side of having bats come to their orchards. They don't realize that bats also have beneficial aspects as well, especially when it comes to durian. But also, we know that cave nectar bats are also pollinating pitaya as well. And there are quite likely a lot of other trees out there that they're helping to pollinate. But we just don't know because the research hasn't been done yet. Mm-hmm. So I can understand that it's difficult to coexist with bats sometimes. People who have flying foxes living in their villages or even in their towns and cities like in Australia, they find it, you know, very annoying having flying foxes in their area. And I don't blame them because flying foxes are noisy and they're messy, you know. It's not easy coexisting with these bats. Mm-hmm. So it's an issue that needs to be managed very carefully. And one of the ways that we can hopefully do that is to collect this kind of evidence to show people how bats are beneficial and how bats are actually helping us. And hopefully, if we can collect more of this evidence and we can show, you know, this kind of video footage to people to say, this is how bats are actually helping. This is, you know, one positive aspect of bats. Maybe it might help to change people's perceptions of bats. We hope that it might help people develop more positive attitudes to bats and maybe be more supportive of bat conservation efforts.
What kind of research on flying foxes do you think we need more of in the country and why?
Well, we need to really document the ecosystem services that flying foxes are providing for us. I think that is very, very crucial to counter the negative image that people have of bats, because it's not enough to just legally protect bats or, you know, protect their roost sites. Because if people still have this negative perception of bats, there will always be that temptation to break the law and kill bats. So we really need to reach people's hearts and minds and get them to change their perceptions, change their way of looking at bats, change their behavior when it comes to bats, and get them to see bats in a more positive light so that they don't want to kill bats and they want to conserve bats and prevent bats from going extinct. So we really need to win people over, because if people don't believe that bats are important, if they don't believe that it's important to conserve bats, then it's not enough if we just simply protect bat species, or if we protect bat roosts, because there will always be people who want to see bats eradicated. So we need to change people's minds as well. And in order to do that, we need to do the research that shows why bats are important, why bats are beneficial. At the same time, we also need to find out, we need to understand the conflict situation between bats and people as well. So we need to understand, is it true that bats are actually causing damage in orchards? You know, how much economic loss is this causing? And if this is the case, then we need to come up with effective mitigation options to address this conflict in a way that can produce a win-win solution for both the bats and the farmers as well. So help the farmers avoid damage, but at the same time also avoid bats getting killed.
Mm-hmm. And I think another very important thing is to stop people from thinking that bats are just, you know, disease-carrying pests.
Yes, yes. That's actually very important because, you know, throughout the history of humans coexisting with bats, there's actually been very few cases of bats actually transmitting diseases to humans. So, for example, even when it comes to rabies, there are actually more rabies transmissions from dogs than there are from bats.
Right.
And yet people just blame bats disproportionately. Bats have coexisted with humans for so long, you know, for centuries, and they've, you know, been able to coexist peacefully without actually transmitting diseases to humans. And yet because now there's this focus on bats and disease, people start associating bats with viruses and with disease outbreaks. And then people start thinking that maybe bats should be eradicated, maybe we shouldn't be coexisting with bats. And this is absolutely the wrong attitude.
So I guess then, you know, with all these findings that you have, you know, and it's, I think, quite a breakthrough that you've made in bat conservation, what do you hope, you know, will come of these findings? How are you going to take this forward?
Well, the next step after this, hopefully, is to actually conduct outreach. So I really want to communicate my results to the general public and to local communities and policymakers. So I want to find a way to translate my research results into awareness and education materials that can be used to show people why it's important to conserve flying foxes. At the same time, I do want to take my research further. I want to investigate durian pollination ecology in further detail and to really understand what's involved in producing healthy durian fruit and how wildlife, maybe different types of wildlife, are involved in that. I also feel very strongly that it's important to address the conflict situation. And because this is so, it's been so poorly studied, it's so poorly understood, we really need to conduct studies to find out what exactly is going on in these orchards that are being visited by bats. Is there actual damage caused by bats? And if so, how can we mitigate this in an effective way? So that's the next sort of future directions for my research after this.
Okay. All right. Thank you so much, Shima. I've been speaking to Dr. Shima Abdul Aziz. She's the co-founder, president, and principal investigator at RIMBA, which is a conservation research group. And if you'd like to find out more about Shima's research or about the work that RIMBA does, you can go to their website, which is rimbaresearch.org. This has been Earth Matters on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.